My name is John Marty. I was told that the more interesting, the more dull the talk is, the more interesting the title better be to get people here. But Pat Robertson is... it worked. Pat Robertson proclaims boldly in the presidential race, which he hasn't definitely joined yet, that he is the Christian candidate and he's God's choice. And he's not alone. I think Christians of every philosophy, we like to think God is on our side. And yet, coming from every different political philosophy, he can't be on everybody's side on every issue. And how do we know what party and what candidates Christ would have us support? Before getting into any more of this, I'll give you my background. It'll tell you a little bit about where I'm coming from. And that means those who disagree, it'll help give you a better starting point for our discussion. My background is that as of last November, I was elected a state senator in Minnesota. I am a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, the DFL party, which is Minnesota's own unique version of what's the Democratic Party elsewhere. I'm a former legislative researcher, so while I'm new to elective politics, first time I've run for anything, I have worked for 4 years as a researcher and committee administrator in the Minnesota House of Representatives, and had worked for a year in Washington with the U.S. Congress, so familiar with the political system, been interested in it for a long time. It's only now my first chance to try it from the elected side. And like all of you, I'm a sinner and a concerned Christian. And to talk about Christian disagreement in politics, some people like Pat Robertson would have us believe that Christians are to believe this, and it's very clear, and the Bible tells us so, and that's where we're all coming from. The fact that I can be a Christian and disagree with him, or you can be a Christian and disagree with me, is not surprising. Just look at your own congregations. You can't agree on styles of hymns or worship styles. How can we agree on heated political topics? And while we cannot agree ourselves on every political topic, and while Christ himself may not be a member of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, and he may not go out and endorse candidates as much as some candidates would like to believe he has endorsed them, nevertheless, it doesn't mean that Christ doesn't care and that he doesn't take a side and that he doesn't care deeply about how we relate to other people in our very political world. So this talk is about an attempt not to place God in a political party or not to say such and such candidates are his candidates, but rather to try and take a look at maybe where Christ is coming from, how we can, as Christians, decide where we ought to be coming from in candidate support, in party support. I'd like to first say how I try and make decisions as an individual politician, and then go into some of the things that I see as biblical themes, as Christian themes of great concern that may help us in making up our own mind on where we're coming from as Christians. I, as an individual, have to cast between committee votes and votes on the floor of the Minnesota Senate about 2,000 votes a year, just umpteen hundreds of issues on every range of thing from environmental issues, agriculture issues, business issues, labor issues, criminal justice issues. I can't even think of all the committees we have in the legislature at one time, let alone all the types of issues they all deal with. And so for us to try and say, well, God only cares about a few issues, or to say that he's got an agenda for every one of these little ones, now let's try and discuss them, doesn't work very well, because I can't even come up on the top of my head with 20 different issues to talk about. But as a person who is confronted on a daily basis with, you got to vote this way, you don't have a choice, you can't say, well, I don't know. You vote, or you're seen as not voting, which there are one or two times where I honestly didn't have any, I felt my vote would have been a wrong vote for having voted. There were one or two times where I chose not to vote, in addition to the times where you can't be present for a vote. But Otherwise, you basically have to decide sometimes on a few seconds of information, sometimes on a few hours of information, how you're going to vote on something. And in doing this, as a Christian, I try and do what is right in the eyes of God. My views are clearly colored by my environment, my educational background, my experiences, as each of ours as humans are. And as each of our education is imperfect, we don't have all the knowledge, we don't have all that. And plus, as I said, it's colored by where we're coming from. Upper middle class backgrounds for most of us, most of us from largely white communities, we have different experiences than people who are in different categories of life, and we don't see the whole world the way God might see it from a different perspective. But I try to do what I think is right. Doesn't mean I always agree with all my constituents. I don't see my role as taking a poll of them, and if 55% support one thing and 45 support the opposite, I'm going to go with the 55%. I see the role as an elected person is taking into account what the public wants and is one of the factors that goes into the judgment. But I am also there to use my judgment, my chance to spend 20 hours a day during the session researching the issues, studying the issues, issues that you may have no more time than to read the daily paper to fill yourself in on. And so I don't see my role as trying to take a poll on every issue. 2,000 issues, it's impossible. Many of them you wouldn't care about, you wouldn't know anything about, or whatever. So deciding that 60% support one thing and 40% the other, it's not like it's going to be 99% are in favor of this and 1% opposed. It's usually 40, 60, 55, 45. If you took a poll, most of the time it breaks down that way. So I try and do what I think would be of best service to the people of Minnesota and my district. And I try and do things that I see would be morally correct and proper in the eyes of God. And in doing so, because of all these limitations that I've discussed, I don't go out there and I don't have the boldness to proclaim I'm the Christian candidate or God is on my side. And yet I do hope that I hope I'm on God's side. I hope I'm not doing things that are contrary to his will, but I think there's a big difference between me inside thinking I'm pretty sure this is the way I ought to be voting. This is the right thing to support. I have strong political convictions, as I'm sure most of you do, and we think we support them because we think it's the right position. But that doesn't mean that we can go out and take one step further and say to the public, I'm supporting this because that's God's position. There's a big difference between what seems to be a subtle point there. And besides that, if I did come out and say I support this because it's God's position, I'm sure those of you who disagree with me would be quick to point that out. So for purposes of our discussion and reflection, I'd like to propose not a political party or a slate of candidates that are Christ's candidates, but rather some strong biblical concerns that we might be able to use in looking at political issues. First of all, Christ was born into a world that had as much injustice and hatred as our own world. Sometimes Americans like to talk about the good old days. I read an article recently about eye gouging in the backwoods in the 1800s in the South and the kind of brawling, backwoods brawling they did, and how objects seemed to be how you could disfigure your opponent most, taking out their eyeballs. And those were the good old days in some people's eyes. And, things weren't better 200 years ago. The society, in my view of things, it's not going downhill. It may not be going uphill at a great rate or going downhill a little bit. I think you can say some things society is learning. Society is becoming more humane, more Christian. In some ways, in other ways, probably going the other way. But Christ was born into a largely hostile world like he would face today. People hating each other, people at war with each other. Great injustices where people were starving and others had too much wealth. Then as now. And in confronting the evils of that time, we found not somebody who's a harsh applicator of the law when he meets the woman who had committed adultery at the well, and he doesn't say, "I condemn you." They talk about in the other story about how we should stone this woman because she's an adulteress, and that's what the law specified, stoning. And he says, "Let whoever is without sin cast the first stone," and nobody does. And he says, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." And a loving, compassionate way for sinners, which is us. And someone who seems to be less interested in legalism than in compassion. And in looking through the whole Bible, not trying to pick out certain texts to prove a point, to say Christ supports this, here's where in John such and such it says this, and therefore I'm going to support that, but looking at the whole picture of the Bible, I picked out three themes that I like to propose as Christian concerns. The three would be poverty and economic justice. The second one would be peace. And the third one would be general category of human rights. As far as poverty goes, there's no more frequent discussion of any we might call social or political issue in the Bible than that of poverty. From the Old Testament prophets Amos talking about people trampling on the poor, the Leviticus, the discussion of the year of Jubilee, where every 50 years all private property goes back to its original family. In effect, the total, what's yours is no longer yours. We all start even every 50 years. If you happen to be upper class and I happen to be lower class, we're going to end up the same every 50 years. That's a radical concept that would do away with poverty every 50 years. Concern for the poor in that and in the Old Testament prophets. In Christ, talking in Matthew 25 about how on Judgment Day, separate people on the left and the right and say, "I was hungry and you fed me, naked and you clothed me, and you took care of me." And people say, "Well, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or naked and clothe you?" And he says, "When you did it to the least of these." When we did it to the poor, when we take care of those in poverty and need, we address those concerns. And yesterday at Paul Hansen's discussion, we talked some about different interpretations of the Bible as far as war and peace goes. And I don't want to get too much into different styles of interpretation here. I'm not an expert in that. One thing that has always bothered me is how people who literally interpret the Bible often fail to literally interpret certain parts of it. When we talk about feeding the hungry and clothing the naked, we tend to be spiritualizing. Oh, we're feeding them spiritually, not food, even though there are starving people, and even though clothing people, when Luke talk about if anyone has two coats and his neighbor has none, let him give one to his neighbor. I mean, how many of us have more than two coats, and how many people in the world don't have any clothes? And not coat for coat, but dollar-wise, we have plenty to share, and we don't. And when we interpret the Bible literally, why do we fall down there? And there are clearly some people, I think of Ron Sider, who I think has been to Holden in the past, has written numerous books on topics of poverty and hunger. And politically, I'm probably a lot closer to him than theologically. He talks about if you don't do these things, you're going to be damned to hell. And he takes the Bible very literally, and he takes every part of it literally. But throughout the Bible, there's a real deep running theme about concern for the poor, for an economically just system. In the theme of peace, Christ throughout yesterday's topic, Paul Hansen was getting into it a lot more in detail. The idea of, is it a warring God, the warring God of the Old Testament, which is he read some passages that you couldn't help but cringe, bashing the heads of babes, awful stuff. And that's God's people, and that's God's commands. How does that fit in with the peace Christ, the peacemaker? Blessed are the peacemakers. Don't want to get into the whole theme of, again, the interpretation styles of the Bible, but as he was pointing out, when you look at things in context, we don't see a God, Christ, proclaiming an eye for an eye. He's saying, let's move past that. Let's move to love your neighbor as yourself. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, turn and give him the other cheek. We're seeing a peacemaker Christ, and one of the best examples I like to see in that, Christ talks often about, while he's being persecuted, he tells his disciples, he tells Pilate, he tells everyone, don't you know, if I wanted to, I could, or Pilate's telling him, why don't you speak up, why don't you defend yourself, don't you know what we could do to you? He's saying, listen, if it wasn't for God's will, you wouldn't have any power, don't you realize, well, I could crush your armies, and he speaks very clearly about that. But when he's being betrayed and Peter cuts off the ear of the high priest's slave, it's a very touching thing. Those who live by the sword die by the sword. He goes and tells him, put away your sword, and he heals the ear. It's just one small example of a humane, compassionate, peaceful God who's confronting a world of people who are ready to kill him. And how does he respond in that peaceful way? And I noticed in the bookstore they have the little pins that were taken from an old fighter bomber, the metal from that, and made into the shape of a plowshare. And from Isaiah, you shall beat your swords into plowshares, and nations shall not lift up sword against nation. And the whole overall theme of the Bible shows Christ as a peacemaker in a very violent world. And I'd suggest peace is a second theme. And the third would be the human rights, human dignity, compassion for all who suffer. And this is very much tied in with the other two. I don't know that these are three equal things, but the human compassion, human dignity may involve an economically just, peaceful world. Human rights, I don't mean simply those who are tortured for their political beliefs, though in Soviet Union, in South Africa, in umpteen countries around the world, left and right governments torture people and brutally torture people, things that make you cringe just to hear what they do. And we've all heard stories about that. We've all read about it. It's incredibly sad how cruel humans can be to each other, trying to find less visible ways of torturing people. So if they later have to release them, they have no scars from their torture. In concocting high-tech ways of torture, it's just gruesome, some of the things you can read about. That is one part of human rights and human dignity, but that's not the only part. We also have abused children, we have battered women, we have homeless who need the dignity of a shelter. You look at homeless shelters, I don't know, some of you have probably volunteered at them. There's not much dignity. There are people who are down and out, whether because of alcoholism or mental illness or just couldn't find a job and their life fell apart. And they don't have the dignity other than a bed next to other people. Their lives are a shambles. There's no dignity there. I think that's part of this concern. The lonely, we often forget of the lonely who suffer. I think of people who are alone at Christmas and holidays when most of us are most happy. It aggravates the loneliness in them. That kind of suffering I see a great concern to Christ, and that again is this whole biblical theme. The one I think we've got to be cautious, as Paul Hansen talked yesterday about picking out biblical verses and using them to justify things. But one of the most beautiful verses in the Bible is where Mary has been informed that she is going to be the mother of Christ, and my soul rejoices in God my Savior. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. His mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things. The rich he has sent empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy. And it's a beautiful way of him talking about how he cares about, Mary is talking about how he cares about people, the compassion for people. She clearly, she is the lowly handmaiden, was chosen by God. Christ did not choose to be born into the world as a wealthy king, as he had the power to do. He came in as a carpenter's son. He came in a time of poverty into not a family that didn't have the money or didn't have the influence to stay at the inn when they were in Bethlehem. Sometimes as little kids, the story we hear about the manger scene, it's, there was no room in the inn and it was just too full, so they had to stay in the barn. Heavily pregnant woman, well, as camping the few weeks before we came here, we had nights where we couldn't find a place to stay either, but if you're desperate and if you have money, you'll find a place. They will find room for you in the inn. They don't put you out in the barn, especially with a pregnant woman. There's no indication that Christ was born into a wealthy family. It was a working class family. He didn't, his birth bed is in some straw with some cattle. It's, when we think of it, the one Christmas carol, Jesus, Jesus, rest your head, you have got a manger bed, all the evil folks on earth sleep in feathers at their birth. That one touches a little, that one touches on a, making it, I remember singing that in grade school, and back then when you sang, we had a Christmas pageant in grade school, and thinking, you know, hey, that's pretty powerful stuff. And Christ chose to identify with the poor, with the oppressed, with the victims of war and injustice. And I'd like to suggest that those are three themes that we as Christians ought to be looking at in determining where we come from. And I do want to leave a full half hour for discussion of this, because I hope this is generating some discussion. But want to move a little further. How do we take these? If these are the three themes that I've picked out, and I'm sure others may have some other ones, though these are very broad ones. These are not trying to be specific. Last night, a number of people who were here were also watching the Ruth Young Doll Nelson film, and we had a good discussion at that time. Some people who were clearly supporting her right to protest against Trident submarines, but what alternative do we have to it? We had people on both sides of the issue on whether we need Trident submarines or not. I'm sure in this room there's a lot of disagreement on specific issues. Blessed are the peacemakers. Well, how do we make peace? From these general themes, how do you break it down to specific action? And I'm not going to, I could spend all day arguing for any specific issue you want me to argue on. And next week I do have a number of talks on specific issues. But what I do want to leave it with is that I think working from these basic Christian compassion areas is how we have to, as individual Christians, go after getting involvement in politics. And I'm a big believer in the fact that Christians ought to be involved and that it's our responsibility to be involved. Everything in life deals with it. And to say, oh, we care about these issues, we give money to the food shelf at our church, we bring food in every Sunday, does that address the whole problem of hunger? Is that the way we should be doing it? The real responses to most issues in society is through politics. We in a democracy set up this system, so we, in a system of anarchy where everybody does whatever they feel like, government's not responsible for it there because there is no government. In our system, in every system, government is where the decisions of allocations of resources, all of these issues have to be decided. And for us as Christians to say politics is dirty, well, religion isn't always a pleasant area to discuss either. And there are clearly, I don't doubt for one minute that Pat Robertson is a very committed Christian, though we may be at the opposite side on numerous political issues. I don't doubt that every person in this room is here at Holden Village because they're concerned Christians. And yet, I think if you took a poll on any issue, you're going to find substantial disagreement even here. And that simply leaves us, in some of my future talks I want to get into more, the idea of how we have moral certainty in the next talk, how we can know, am I on the right side? Should the church take a position on this issue? That kind of concern. But for now, I'd just like to leave it that we as individuals have to study the issues. We have to be involved. Saying politics is too nasty for me to get involved in. Christ was clearly involved in a lot of controversial issues. He didn't duck issues. He talked about all these things that we're talking about. And we as humans concerned about others, we can't say, there's nothing I can do about it. There is, and it's through the political process, whether that be through education, whether that be through voting, whether that be through getting elected to office. Each of us has a role as a citizen in our society to be involved. And how we as individuals relate these Christian concerns is going to be imperfect. That's why we have disagreement. We're all human. All parties and all candidates have failings. The less failings a candidate gives to themselves, the more suspicious one might be of them. If they are so sure they are so right, maybe we should do the looking into themselves that they haven't done. But from that, the fact that a candidate may not properly say, I'm the Christian candidate, and maybe when a preacher in church or a Christian group involved on a political issue has to be cautious in talking about how Christ tells us this is what we are to do, that doesn't mean that we as individuals aren't supposed to dig deeper and decide what we personally think is morally right and fight for it and fight hard for it. I guess my biggest disagreement with Pat Robertson's theology is just his certainty. He is speaking for Christ. And I find that arrogant for him to be saying, and at that somebody I disagree with, to be saying, Christ is on my side, you disagree with me, you're immoral. I have real problems with that. I don't have problems with the fact that he may, deep down inside him, believe he has chosen the right position on an issue. I too believe the same about myself. I wouldn't be doing what I do if I didn't care strongly and feel I was right about what I was doing. But to go one step further and say, God's on my side, is something that I think is inappropriate. And with that, I see we have about a half hour left. And I hope that has been enough to stimulate a lot of either questions or discussion or argument or whatever people want to do.
Sure. I'd be curious, what kind of problem do you run into as a Christian legislator, as a Christian politician? What are the struggles that you experience?
Well, one of them is certainly that there are times when the public doesn't like to hear that their legislators are ill-informed, and I think I'm a well-informed legislator, but with 2,000 votes, there are times you get to the Senate floor and there's a vote going on, and what are we voting on? What are we voting on? And you get one sentence from somebody, and there were a couple of times, as I said, I decided I didn't know enough to vote on it. But if you're at all familiar with the issue, you try, and your moral duty in my mind is to do what you think is going to be the right thing. And from maybe it's three sentences on exactly what the amendment is on, plus looking at the voting board and finding people you trust and whose philosophies are similar to yours, and looking at them, a combination of things. But it's still a real uneasy feeling. You want to study in depth all of these things so that you feel comfortable with them. And I'm never going to feel, you just don't have the time. It's just not possible. That's one real dilemma. And then there are many times where even after studying an issue very in depth, you're not sure which you think is the right way. And finally, there's the thing where you simply have two very difficult choices. The dollar amount in the budget is going to be this much for human services, and should we spend that money on people with this kind of disability, or should we spend it on this kind of care for the elderly, or what? And you can argue, well, we ought to do both of them, but political reality isn't always give you that choice, since you're often pitting two things that you value equally against each other, and that's a tough one too.
John, this follows up a little bit on Joe's question there. How do you prepare yourself for those moments? I'm curious on how you prepare yourself for trying to practice that kind of discernment. What's vital to you in terms of corporate life and prayer and reflection on biblical themes and so on? Could you shed some light on that?
Sure. I guess what I'd like to say about that is a lifelong shaping thing. All of I don't, when I come up with a political issue, I don't start thumbing through the Bible and how does God want me to act on it? It's not the way I hear some people may do that once in a while. I don't know that that's a very valuable way of doing, making political judgments. And I guess a lot of it's just a lifelong process of drawing in everything you've seen about an issue of like poverty, what you see, where people are suffering, how they're suffering. Talk of welfare reform, are people poor because they're lazy, or are they poor because they can't find a job, or they're not qualified for a job, or they're illiterate, or their spouse left them and three kids and they don't have any skills and haven't worked for 15 years. All of those things come in there to helping you make a judgment, and about all you can do is pray that you do have compassion and wisdom to make wise decisions, and never knowing for sure as humans whether we are or not. But it's not like the kind of, you don't have a lot of time for any kind of reflection during the legislative session. Our session is it's the first half of the year, generally about 6 months 1 year, about 3 months the other year. And it's very intense during that time. It's not uncommon to come home at 3 a.m. and be back the next morning at 8 or 9. And I could make good arguments about why that's not a good way to do things when you got the full year to do it, and maybe you ought to spread things out a little bit differently than that. But that's the way the process works, and I can make my little attempt to change it. But in the meantime, and if that happens, human nature is you get that much more information to digest. You don't have a lot of time for deep reflection.
I would feel very much at ease if I knew all legislators were as conscientious as you and would make ethical decisions based on your conscience more than on the money from PACs and who gets your ear, who dines and wines you, rather than deciding it on your own, even though your constituents might not agree with you also. How do you feel the other, now you can't speak in numbers, do we have a majority? Just take Minnesota as an example.
Sure.
As far as, first of all, as far as people who are Christian, and I'm not advocating that we ought to have a Christian legislature, or a Christian Congress, or a Christian government, because, I mean, I think people of other faiths and other beliefs. Right, but as far as, I just wanted to point out, first of all, that in terms of religious faith, I've seen more studies of the federal, of the U.S. Congress than our legislature, but 95-99% of members of U.S. Congress are church-going Christians, whether it's every Sunday or not so often, I don't know, but most, vast majority of them, like the vast majority of the public, profess a belief in a supreme being. And same thing in our legislature as well. In terms of politics, of course, they range the whole range of the spectrum. In terms of how they make their decisions, which is what your question was, there's, and this is something that I don't want to say, that that members who decide things in a different way are bad for doing so, because they clearly feel they see their role a little bit differently than I would. But out of, we have 67 state senators, and out of them, I'd say maybe 7 or 8 would, despite the whatever their constituents wanted, even if it was 2-1 in strong opposition to a position they took, that that maybe 10% of legislators would, without regard to their own political future, whatever, take that position, vote the tough vote. And they'll call them tough votes or easy votes, and we all talk that way at the legislature. This is a real easy vote. Interesting kind of issue is the pay raise kind of issue, because legislators in virtually every state, including our own, basically set their own salary. And it's always the one, the worst vote politically you can do is to vote to raise your salary. So you have always, we need 34 votes to pass something, you have 34 or 35 votes to raise the salary, and there are 2 or 3 that don't take the full salary once it's raised. They all want the salary increase, half of them vote for it. Those are the, quote, tough votes they talk about, and then the easy ones, you vote against the tax bill, that's always an easy vote. That kind of thing, and I'd say that there are about 10% who would vote their conscience rather than what they perceive as the wishes of their constituency, regardless of the issue. And that's not saying, again, I want to make it clear, I'm not saying the other 90% are bad people for that. Many of them feel their role, and I think many of you would feel the role of a legislator, of a politician, is to reflect the wishes of the constituency. And as I expressed earlier, I have problems with that, partly because there's no perfect way of determining the wishes of the constituency. Second of all, the constituency doesn't have the time to study the issues. And third of all, if my constituents want me to vote for something that I think is wrong deep down inside me, I think it's just immoral, or I think it's devastating to people's lives, I'm not going to vote for that. And if they choose to throw me out of office in 4 years, that's their opportunity. And that's the way I think the system has to work. So I personally like to see people who will do the conscience voting rather than the delegate voting, if you want to call it that, where they're voting what they perceive to be their constituents' wishes. And again, that's just a style. Some of the ones who are voting their constituent wishes are not doing it because that's what they think is right. Some of them, and I don't want to imply my motives are perfect or anybody else's are all bad, or everybody's motives are somewhat mixed. And you blend these things together and in our own ways, and we're all sinners. We all make mistakes. But there are some people who more than others vote the way their constituents do simply because they want to keep in the job. And they're scared to death they'll get beat if they vote against the majority opinion. there are others who honestly try and reflect it, and probably most are sort of a compromise category. If they feel real strongly about something, they're going to vote their will, unless their constituents are so overwhelmingly against it, they do. But most of the time, people have a mixture of reasons for doing it.
Or
that's, yes, that's another factor, and to me probably the biggest issue we could do to reform our government, especially at the federal level, is campaign finance reform. It's one of the few organizational matters of government that I think has a real social impact. But when there's a special interest against the public interest, if the public is well informed on it, the public's going to win. In most cases, it's a matter of public not having the time to be informed, not too many issues. Newspapers don't report them, so even if you read every word of the newspaper, you're not going to hear a word about it. And then those interest groups tend to win. I had a bill this year, I'm on Public Utilities and Energy Committee, had a number of bills dealing with utility companies. And my philosophy in that field is that these are necessities. The public needs them. You can't live without gas and electric in Minnesota or most places. And there's one supplier. You can't really have 20 telephones in your house, each one having its own system of lines, and you use the one that's cheapest. Can't do the same with electric suppliers. Can't do the same with gas, which has to be piped in. There's no competition there, so we got to regulate them, and we've got to control the prices, because otherwise they'd charge whatever they could get, and since people need it, they could charge whatever they wanted. So we have a regulatory system. I had a bill that would require them to pass the savings they got from the Federal Tax Reform Act, which cut income taxes massively, pass that on to consumers. It died in committee. The largest utility companies in Minnesota had about 12 lobbyists that have about 10 issues they're working on. Mine was one of them, and here I have maybe 1/40th of my time to lobby on this bill and to push the bill. Died in committee. I asked to have it reconsidered, lobbied each of the committee members individually, turned around one vote, got it out of committee. It died on the floor. I brought in our Public Utilities Committee Commission and bipartisan members of it, and they lobbied heavily, and we got it through the Senate, and then it died in the House. So that's the kind of thing where a well-paid, they contributed to my opponent, they contributed to lots of incumbents, they have a lot of clout, and the public doesn't have the time to know what the Federal Tax Reform Act did to utilities, doesn't have the time to know that maybe they ought to be passing on some of those savings. And yet the public interest is clearly served by keeping their rate of return is a fair rate, but not excessive, and keeping utility rates to customers as low as they can be. And so, yes, the lobbies have incredible clout there. And not the healthy part they provide is information, but it's clearly information designed to support their point of view. The unhealthy part is most legislators listen very carefully. A $300 contribution doesn't buy your vote. I'd say that's very seldom. It may happen, but it's seldom. The problem is if somebody gives you $300, you don't close your door, "I'm sorry, I don't have time to meet with you." And that's a real shame. And it's best exemplified by the fact that right after the election, I got a note from a lobbyist whose organization, he said, had the misfortune of having contributed $400 to my opponent. Here's $400 as they wish to make amends. It shows the whole problem with it. I mean, they didn't give money to my opponent because they thought he was a great thing for the state of Minnesota. They didn't turn around because all of a sudden they decided I was a great thing for the state of Minnesota. They wanted to make sure that I'd listen to their interests. And I hope I listen to their interests, but I hope I listen to their opponent's interests just as heavily, despite no contribution. And it's not like that's some immoral group. It happened to be a lobbying group, which I'd rather not name, but it was a medical profession related thing. And And I hope I do give them a fully fair hearing, but I also hope I'm not influenced by that contribution. And I have to accept those contributions. It costs good money to run campaigns, and it also costs money to, our constituent newsletters are paid for by us. All that stuff comes out of our campaign budgets.
How do you balance, when we talk about poverty and economic justice, how do you balance that, the need for government to have some mechanism of providing for the poor, and yet that responsibility that we as church members or the community have to help in that? I live in Yakima, Washington, and the Yakima Valley, we have about, I think, 14% unemployment, much higher than national average. We have a large problem of drugs. We have a high, we have the highest percentage of unwed pregnancies in the whole state. I think something like 21% of the population is on welfare. We have a high migrant population. And I come from a large upper middle class, you know, Anglo Lutheran church, and basically a lot of people in church say, well, there's, you know, people can go to the mission, they can go down to the welfare office. There are, you know, there are systems out there to take care of people. I mean, it never, I guess, never ceases to amaze me how blind we can be to that. And also the, I know a number of school teachers who will say that there are, you know, senior girls who will say right up front that that's their plan for life, is to get pregnant. Because then they can get on welfare, and they, you know, and it's, they think they'll not make it in college, they'll not, you know.
Yeah.
So that's their choice. You know, where how do you deal with all those responsibilities, whose responsibility, all that?
Yeah, I see somebody else wants to.
Can I just add one thing, because that's very close to the question that I wanted to ask, which is, as voters and also as legislators, how do you sort out those legislative issues before you, where one has a positive social impact that you would like to see manifested in society, but tagging along behind it is a result or an impact on another area that is not so positive? And that's exactly, I'm from Oregon, but we have a very comparable problem in our county of welfare being, by many felt anyway, being misused by young girls who want to be emancipated. So we have a very high rate of unwed pregnancies, which leads also in our county to a very high degree of abandonment of child abuse. Mm-hmm. So we have all these systems building up to kind of pick up the pieces that the other system is creating. How do you approach that as a voter for us and as a legislator for you?
Well, I guess I heard a little bit about two issues, one of which, and I'm going to clarify that I hear what the questions are, one of which is, and it's what I first thought you were saying, and then it changed, and that was, what's the church's role, what is the role of nonprofit food shelves, of shelters for the homeless, church missions, in effect, as opposed to what's government's role? And the second one being the fact that a lot of the things government has done to address social problems have had unpleasant consequences. And those two questions, that's what I'm hearing the two of you are saying. Is that correct? Okay. As far as the role of the church versus social nonprofit organizations versus government's role in being, and I'm sure there will be people who disagree with me on this, but I do see one of the purposes of our lives as Christians is to help those in need, and one of the things that may involve is working for a just society that takes care of those needs, and the second being that when there are unmet needs, we give out of our own pocket to help those in need. And Christ talked numerous times about give what you have to the poor. Sell all you have and give it to the poor. He clearly is talking that way. What I'd say, though, in how I separate the two, is first of all, the church, the poor have never been taken care of by the church, by nonprofit organizations in general. When Reagan first took office in 1981, there was a lot of talk, hey, why don't we give it back to the churches? The churches have always had concern for the poor. Why should government should get out of it? That way we lower taxes, people will be more generous. Well, looking at personal incomes of candidates who do this and how much they give away to the poor, I'm not sure they believe that themselves. Mm-hmm. And besides that, the church has never done that. The church has had poverty around it throughout the ages. And the church has tried. In recent years, I think it's tried very valiantly to meet needs. But there have always been, the poor you always have with us. Maybe government and the church combined will never address the problems adequately. I happen to think there's the potential to do it right, but the church alone couldn't do it. When one of the things when Reagan was suggesting that the church ought to do this rather than that, was if you took all the poor families below the poverty line and dished them up to churches, you'd have 10 families. I mean, that may be one more than one person. These are families of two or more. Maybe a family of four being an average for a welfare, a poverty level family, some of them larger. You'd have to dish up 10 of them to every church in the country to take care of their full needs if you dropped all the welfare programs. Our church is a moderately large sized church, and if it dropped most everything else it did, it could do that. There are also some of you who are members of churches with 80 families, and taking care of 10 additional families on a church budget, not only couldn't you hire a pastor or anything else, you couldn't meet the 10 families' needs anyway. The church never could meet all those needs, and when it had a chance before government stepped in, you read Charles Dickens' novels about how awful things were in England 100 years ago, you see that there's church has always been around, and poverty's always been around, and the church has done little bits and pieces here. Usually we throw in a few bucks for the poor, and we have a hunger offering a couple times a year, and food shelves in more recent years every week even. But in terms of social needs, it's not going to meet them. And therefore, what I'd argue is that government ought to, for the good of all of society, not just the good of the poor, but the good of everyone, society ought to take care of those social needs, and the church fill in where it can. As far as then, has government done a good job? No. I wouldn't. Your statement and follow-up was that the government's done good things, but it's also led to some additional side consequences. I'd argue that it's more than additional side consequences. The programs have been somewhat, at times, misdirected. That's human nature. I mean, every business makes mistakes, government makes mistakes, and we're told hundreds of times how many mistakes government makes. If you want to botch things up real good, turn it over to the government. Somebody said, if we want to really break up organized crime, we ought to turn it over to the government, then it would just fall apart. And they're good jokes like that all the time, but government is no more perfect and maybe less perfect than business or education or any other kind of social structure we have, and it has made some failings. My argument on how we deal with those problems is, what we shouldn't do is toss out our welfare programs. What we ought to do is reform them. And everybody talks about welfare reform, and my first real introduction into the political world, when I was a sophomore in college, I saw an essay contest, and it was a big bucks contest, $5,000, which 10 years ago was real big bucks for a college student. And I thought, wow, this is a way to help pay my way through school. And I wrote a 50-page essay on welfare reform, and it won, and I got a lot of money out of it. And I was, they flew us out to Washington for this thing, and the big banquet, and this Institute for Social Economic Studies had a big forum on, it was a welfare reform organization. I can look back at the paper I wrote then, it was a 50-page thing, and look at the ideas there. I might refine them a little bit, but I'd say basically the same ideas I had 10 years ago about what we have to do. We still have to do them, we haven't done them. And one of the types of problems, and it's not going to exactly address the one you said about people getting pregnant to get on welfare, and that is that we have an idea of deserving poor and undeserving poor in our country. And because of that, we have a welfare system that tries to be more generous to some than to others. If you have a kid and you're poor, you're more deserving than if you're an unemployed single male. You don't get any welfare in most states. And so, or a single female. So you have a kid and you get on welfare. Part of our trouble is we want people to be deserving of the money we give them. And as a result of that, Ronald Reagan talked earlier about the truly needy. Let's get all the non-poor off of welfare, and just the real poor who are going to be starving if we don't give them food, put them on welfare. I mean, and they have been on welfare, but take everyone else off it. Trouble, I would argue, is that the way to reform welfare would be the exact opposite. Not by cutting everybody who's on the fringe off, but by making it so that if you're on the fringe, that you're better off if you work than if you don't work. By making just the truly needy get it, if you earn a dollar, if you're on welfare and you get enough to meet your true needs, then you earn a dollar, you're no longer truly needy by that $1, so our system takes it away from them. So you earn a dollar, you lose a dollar. In effect, you lose more than you earn because of some other benefits you would get. And so our system is set up in such a way that in order to be stingy on welfare, we force more people onto it. Somebody who is divorced or spouse just ran away and left him with a couple of kids may need a year of education to get into a job, may need some medical care while they work, but you know, they work and they lose their medical assistance. They go on welfare, they may earn about the same as they'd get from a minimum wage job, but they get health care too. So it'd be stupid not to go on welfare.
It seems to me that somewhere along the line we were giving money to people and we thought that met the need. You know, I think that's the big mistake that we've made, thinking that people's needs are being met physically. People still have that need for self-respect. They have that need to be loved, and I think that's where we, the church, can come in. Because I think the church has a real need, has a real responsibility to reach out to people and help them, whether they've got their check coming or not.
Exactly. One other thing on that, and is that we cannot. You can't ignore the fact that people need money to buy food and shelter and so on. Unless we're going to have them in a. If you're poor, you're going to be in a poor house and maybe even a nice poor house. But unless we want to do that, we have to give them money to get things. But you also need, and more important, as you said, is self-respect. And to me, the best way to do that is through a job. If you are unemployed because of illiteracy, because of mental illness, and a lot of the people we think of as lazy, I think are mentally ill. And so if we don't take care of that need for work, and I'd say that's a real high priority for welfare reform, is putting people to work. Jobs that they can grow in and where they can contribute something into life. I think that's critically important, and that's part of that self-respect I think you're... And the church does have a role there too. People who are friendless because of mental illness or whatever, we need to reach out to them.
How many constituents do you represent, and how do you keep in touch with them?
About 65,000, and when they contact me, I respond. I intend to do a little bit of going door to door in certain neighborhoods just to keep in touch that way.
Is it a city or a rural area?
It's half city, half four suburbs north of St. Paul and a corner of the city of St. Paul. So it's half city and half suburban population wise. There's no perfect way, and there's no way you as a voter have of knowing everything I'm up to. I mean, you can get information from the legislature, unless you want to make a full-time occupation of knowing what your elected officials are doing. To a certain point, that's one of the failings of our system. And we have to go in a minute, but one more question, I'll stay around if people...
John, what keeps you going in all this? What keeps you a Christian, I mean? I'm thinking of Jim Wallace, who says, the poor are not our problem. We are the problem of the poor. And I look around the world and I ask, who has all of the, or most of the world's wealth and treasures? Answer, North American Christians. Who has most of the world's garbage and environmental pollutants? Answer, North American Christians. Who have most of the world's bombs and guns and Saturday night specials, for that matter, weapons, even in the household? Answer, North American Christians.
I mean, the very people who need conversion the most are the people who pay your salary as a politician, and may I say, who pay my salary as a pastor. And I've got to convert those people in the pew. How do you do it, and how do you not give up on the church?
Okay, well, first of all, I think that one of the things we have as Christians more than anything else is hope. And when you get down and out, I mean, in my job, I got 23 things passed in the law this year. I probably tried about 30. And that's a lot higher percentage than you'd have at federal level, say. But nevertheless, my most controversial ones didn't pass. Some of my best ideas I didn't even introduce this year because they didn't have a chance. Most of the time you lose. You lose more than you win, in effect. And do you give up hope there? Do you give up hope because your constituents seem to be concerned about themselves most? I'd argue that one of the major roles of an elected official, and one of the most sadly lacking roles in an elected official, is that of educating people, being a teacher to people. When I said how I believe if I feel something is right and my constituents would disagree with me, I'll vote for it. But I don't see my role as to vote for it and duck. Hope they don't find out, because most of them wouldn't find out. I also don't go out and advertise, hey, I voted for this thing that you're all going to kill me for. There's an in-between role that I'd argue is not done enough, and that is the role of education. Say, here's why I did this. You may disagree with me, but here's why I supported this issue. And I think the public, I was very surprised, very pleasantly surprised in that way, with the public's willingness to listen. My campaign, I had about 12, 14, 20 pages somewhere in there, depending on how we typed them up, and so on, of issue papers. And I wasn't talking about promising lower taxes and promising more spending on education, which you wouldn't believe how many pieces of campaign literature I've seen that argues for both. We're going to cut your taxes and we're going to spend more on this and this and that. And it works real good if you can figure out a way to do it. But I tried to argue for things that I think work on talking about welfare reform, why I think it's in our best interest not to have little kids going hungry, why it's in our best interest to, even if it costs us money in the short run, to put people to work, why it's in our best interest to help others, in effect, by helping others the lowest in society and by helping those who are at struggling stages of their lives. We all benefit, not just morally, but we benefit economically by having a smooth running economy. And those are things where the public is not going to listen to. I don't think there are 10 constituents who read all my issue papers. I'm sure my opponent did, but I'm not sure who else did. But I'm sure people read bits and pieces of them. And that's part of the educational process. I think the one thing we never do as Christians is give up hope. And that means give up hope with your constituents, with your colleagues, with whoever disagrees with you, but rather let's educate them. And without arrogance, without certainty that I'm right, but it's a pretty strong feeling that what I'm doing is right or I wouldn't be doing it. I think I better call it quits there because we're past our hour, but I'll stay around and...
Let me make a campaign statement, may I? John here worked in Washington, D.C., for a year for Paul Simon, whom I hope you all will vote for the next president.
Pardon? What keeps me going? I didn't mean to, okay, just the faith that I can make a difference, yeah. That's a good way to put it, that you have a chance to...